with plaid stamps your wildest dreams. The plaid stamp catalog sent to you, plain sealed wrapper. Ask for Dream Division. How many loaves of tip-top bread must you devour to realize that wildest of dreams? How many trips to the A&P for true bliss? Yes. Total paradise is within your grasp. So get working on those lamb chops. Don't tarry by the frozen food counter. Hey, Mrs. Marion G. Buckley got a divorce after testifying her husband insisted she look Chinese, dress, speak, and act like a Chinese woman. In Superior Court recently in Los Angeles, the young husband, Brian, testified that at times he became violent and beat his wife when she balked at his demands. Mrs. Buckley explained that it was hard to act Oriental since she was born in London and spoke with a British accent. The couple were married in High Wycombe, Buckinghamshire, England, October 20th, 1956. When they moved to Hong Kong, she did not mind dressing like an Oriental, she said, but when she and her husband came to live in California, she refused to continue the charade. It was terrible trying to be someone that I was not. Even when we went out, I had to wear Chinese dresses, Mrs. Buckley said. A neighbor of the Buckleys, Mrs. Josephine Borum, testified that at first she thought Mrs. Buckley was an Oriental. I was curious and found out that she came from England like myself, the witness said. Mr. Buckley told me that his wife was not all that he wanted, and he said he liked Chinese women and was considering going back to Hong Kong. Oh, plaid stamped world. Oh, world. Oh, lost. Oh, gone. Oh, strivers for the eternal. Oh, reachers for the ultimate. Oh, sing all thy mighty paeans and choruses of sad, unremitting desire, grinding us to wee bits and pieces of lost and gone specks, iotas of humanity. Now you place the first block here, and then you lave it just so with mortar. Just so easily, and then you place the next one atop it this way. And then one by one, you begin to find, you see, this way, along a line like this, with this testing of the plumb line here, you will have a wall, eventually. Yes, and the higher you build the wall, the longer you build the wall, the more secure, the more integrated you shall feel with the earth around you. There is something deep and significant about walls, you know. So come, I will show you. Careful now with that mortar. Very easy there. I place it one upon the other. There. You're doing very well. Keep your knees loose. That's it. Work the trowel with an easy wrist motion. As they say that the blood of 10,000 Chinese went into one of the great walls of the world, that's nothing compared to what we'll use. And it'll last a million years. So come sing. Number 714 in the book. All together now. Mrs. Buckley, will you please give us a few guidance notes on the organ? Oh, beautiful, beautiful. You are singing well. Don't stop now. That's fine. Just keep it up. Now, on the other hand, those of you who feel that perhaps there is something else in the world besides walls, we have many things to talk to you about. Cabbages, kings, shackle boats, that's a good discussion point there, and we could discuss how well string can be rolled after flying a kite on a Sunday afternoon. Come now, we shall do that. Yes, it was terrible trying to be someone that I was not. Even when we went out, I had to wear Chinese dresses. My wife is not all I want, and by George, she's going to act Chinese, or else I'm going to go back to Hong Kong. Actually, I was rather surprised. You see, I thought Mrs. Buckley was an Oriental, but when I found that she was born in England like myself, well, I was rather surprised. Oh, what desirest thou, oh man? Come on, get up, will you? Crying out loud. It's all pot cheese and 4,000 miles wide. Low calorie, high in protein, but rather flat in taste. You feel it rolling over the... That's it. There you are. Just up to the ankles. That's plenty. It's a pleasant feeling in a way, isn't it? And sure, dreams do come true, you know. All one has to do is wish upon a star. Easy, simple. With no effort at all. Your dream shall come true. Yes. You can carve them out of soap if you care. As many of us today try to do. 99.44% pure. With added XG elements for extra beauty. And there is no doubt about it that a large percentage of the population believes today that beauty will solve it all. Yes, sir, I would suggest that you try my fashion steak in 7 fascinating flavors. Yes, pineapple yum yum. And, oh, another thing, too. It'll cover up all nasty blemishes. And premature enlargement of the pores. Here you're beginning to spring a leak. Just be careful now. Oh, but don't be too careful. You see, there are 2 schools of thought on that. 2 schools. 3, 4, 8 million. Actually, 2.5 billion schools of thought. To be honest with you. It comes in a way full circle. Since we're here, we might as well be here. You know, this is the most difficult. Who was it who said, to be or not to be? Who was that? To be or not to be? Who was that? Eugene O'Neill, yes. To be or not to be. And morning becomes, Electra. To be or not to be, I recall the scene well. Now, it was on the front porch, the veranda there, on those long steps. To be or not to be. And that is actually the question, you know. Are you going to be alive or are you not? Or do you wish your dreams to come through the collection of King Korn stamps, thereby achieving life and a set of free plastic dinnerware? And through the free plastic dinnerware, achieve a higher level of existence, to taste ever more clearly and cleanly and more exquisitely of the morning cornflakes. with or without fruit, as desired. But we would suggest that you use a thin cream. All together now. What is said to be the world's biggest cigar is threatening to crumble away. Carl Petau, director of the Buendi Cigar Museum in Buendi, Germany, says a 26-year-old cigar, 5 feet, 6.929 inches long, and 26.378 inches in diameter in the museum in Buendi, Germany, is the world's biggest cigar. The cigar's wrapper leaves are slowly coming off. Tobacco inside is also crumbling. We hope to be able to repair the damage, Mr. Pretau said, but it will be difficult because the cigar must be taken out of its glass container for the repair job. And if it is taken out and found necessary to be used up, Mr. Pretau said that would be difficult too. He added, it would take you some 600 hours to smoke this big cigar. We're rather proud of it here at the museum. What are we trying to do? 5-foot cigars in museums being repaired? I like Chinese women. Not going to get away with this. I'm going back to Hong Kong. Speaking of useless cigars, this is WOR AM and FM New York. And we shall be here until midnight. Yes, we shall be here until midnight. We shall speak of many things before we leave. Oh, I don't know whether to speak of many things. It's like the other day I'm reading this thing in the New York Times. I guess this is one of the reasons why I'm hung on the... excuse me, before we go any further. It has to be pointed out. Just one little touch. I'm watching this ad. You know, I think one of the most beautiful things about our time today is that... Well, I don't think there is a country that has approached this facet of life the way we have done it. We want things, and yet we don't want them in America. It's intriguing. I think that there are more foods today that are disguised to be other foods in America than any other place in the world. But this is one thing. For example, you can get strawberry-flavored cheese if you want. Now, do you want cheese or do you want strawberries? You know, it doesn't matter. You can get hamburger-flavored ice cream. You want that. And for East Side kids, there's a Cointreau ice cream to cover it off, you know, after the dinner. You can get, if you so desire. So tonight, I'm looking at a TV commercial, and it's the interior of a car. And it says, yes, don't you like to have the feeling of that shift stick in your hand? And they go on to tell that coming out of the floor is the shift, the stick. And this stick is a four-place automatic shift. It gives the guy the feeling that he is shifting gears. He can put his hand over there and put it, you know, on the top of that gear shift knob. But he doesn't have to shift gears. It's actually an automatic shift. And so we've come full circle. Oh, yes, and then there's another interesting... everywhere you see these little symbolic things where the original function has been lost, but the shape or the form has been retained. To give you another example of this, there is a car on the market now. In fact, there was a big advertising spread on this thing. And it was supposed to be a custom car. You know, they keep referring to cars that are custom cars. Do you know what a custom car is? Do you really know what a custom car is? Hardly anybody does, you know. And they use the word, and they say, well, that's the custom model. Well, a custom car is a car that is made especially for that customer. And that's how the word originally got to be used that way. They said, well, of course, that's a customer car or a custom car, meaning that the car was specially made for one person. But today, you can buy a whole lot of cars just called it a custom car, you know, and it's just a car with a little more chrome on than the one before it. Usually a custom car, interestingly enough, when customers were calling the shots, were the opposite. They would have the chrome taken off. But, you know, this is a custom car. So one of the most interesting examples, I think, today of the lost shape or the lost form is one of the cars, I think it's the Thunderbird, I'm not sure which one, advertises they have a traditional S-bar. Have you seen that on the side of their hardtop Brougham? All of these contradictions in terms. To begin with, the S-bar was only used on a folding car. But this is a non-folding hardtop car. And still, you know what the S-bar is? Have you seen that S-bar on the side? No, nobody knows. What is it? Don't any of you look at your world? Don't you know what the S-bar is on a car? Haven't you seen that big S? No, I guess not. I'm speaking Greek. Everyone looking blankly at me here. Well, let me point out another one then, if I have to pursue this thing until finally you see what I'm talking about here. That in the case of, let's say, television sets today, a good example of that. Do you know that many television sets are being designed today so they look more like refrigerators than TV sets? Because they have found that people are more comfortable with a refrigerator look than they are with a machine look. Now do you follow me? No. Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, it's an interesting problem. The problem of the cigar in the museum. The guy with the wife who he wants to look like, for some reason or other, like a Chinese girl. Of course, that's something that almost any man can understand. But it seems strange, obviously, to people who read it, who do not hear this kind of thing said so openly and so plainly. I wonder how many people today listening, right now, right at this minute, if they could do it, would have the person they're involved with be an entirely different kind of person. An entirely different kind. Now, I don't mean necessarily just change their personality. I mean really change them. For example, you might be hung up on, this guy was hung up on Chinese girls. So he makes his wife into a Chinese girl. He just says, from now on, you dress like Chinese, you talk like Chinese, and you act like Chinese. That's it. which is a fascinating story. Now, I'm sure that there must be a lot of chicks who are married to guys who drive laundry trucks. But they have a secret desire to be married to a tall, thin guy that comes out of a White House and Hardy ad, out of the New York Times men's clothing supplement, and who apparently works in one of these interesting offices up on Lexington Avenue someplace and only goes in three times a week and spends the rest of his time out on the Sound in a boat. Well, many people do convert people with them into something. Now, they don't do it outwardly in the sense that they just say, from now on, Charlie, you're going to wear an Italian silk suit. They convert them this way in their mind. I had a friend one time, very, very wild story, this friend of mine who had a very definite problem, a psychological problem of this kind. And he was recommended, the doctor who worked with him finally told him this, that to clear up this psychological problem, you must begin to approach the people who are giving you trouble. And in this specific instance, it was his wife. He was very unhappy, and he had conditions that made it so that he couldn't break it off, and he was all involved. And so the doctor said, convert her in your mind to that which you desire. Well, that was pretty hard. It was very difficult. And so he would sit at the breakfast table, and she would come and bring the toast, and he would sit there, and he would look across at her, and he would try somehow to convert this thing into this completely different element, this completely different object, this new character, and you know he was able to do it? Within 6 months, he believed that she was that. Just as I'm quite sure we can if we really do it. Unfortunately, it's so that we can in our mind convert anything to fit anything. We can make the whole thing shape itself into that which we want. Now, of course, this can be very dangerous, Because I listened to a guy today, it's very interesting, a very famous man. Have you ever had the chance to sit next to a very famous man? Somebody whose name is, well, so famous it goes beyond just stars, you know, that kind of thing. But a famous, successful executive, statesman, commentator, goes all the way back 150 years. And you're sitting there listening to him, and you begin to realize that what he is saying has no contact with the reality of now. And he is saying things like, what we ought to do is get strong. We can all get together and change the world. And his feelings were so out of touch. Objective attitudes and objective observation of that which is around me. In other words, where are you hung up? when you're sitting there and you're dealing with your world, at what point do you begin to go off the track? Where do you begin to lose control? Everybody has a point beyond which he begins to slowly slide off objectivity. You know, it's very difficult to on one hand you have the subjective thing. That's the thing that totally emotional. And on the other hand, you have what could be called loosely the objective analysis of a situation or condition. All right, the walls are green. Okay, that's an objective report. Subjective report would be something like, well, I hate green, so I will say the walls are aqua. And I will convince myself that they're aqua, and eventually I will believe that they're aqua. And eventually they are aqua. Well, this of course, is a complete distortion of the kind of thing that is a distortion. But I'm sitting there listening to this important man, and I, wow. And here's a man that's called in to make big decisions all over the world, and a man who is continually being quoted. And it frightened me a little bit, because I know that, I believe that most of us have a feeling that there are little people and there are big people, and big people somehow have a deeper insight into problems of the world, have a much more objective view of the world, and have more knowledge. You know, I've found that most people rise to the top because of one thing. Really. It's sheer aggressiveness in one area or another. Now, aggressiveness takes many forms, and I don't mean what makes Sammy run. This is the most obvious kind of aggressiveness. I mean the kind of aggressiveness that comes from just sitting straight in a chair, one thing. Or the kind of aggressiveness that is probably the most interesting form today is the negative aggressiveness, which we find in many industries. Many outfits today have it. The negative aggressive officer is the one who never says anything to anybody. He just lets everybody else get into trouble. Until one day, one by one, each one is eliminated, and he's still there. It's an interesting kind. You might say he fights a continual battle of attrition. Always people are falling to one side. And the poor little guy who comes up with ideas, of course, is the one who in the end will always get it in the neck. And he's what we usually call aggressive. No, he's quite the opposite in actual practice. Now, again, aggression takes many forms. There are two schools of thought, millions, billions of schools of thought. And then, speaking of perception, probably one of the most difficult things in the whole field of perception is to know how, say, somebody. Oh, an interesting letter in connection with this. A woman wrote to me the other day and says, Shepherd, something, and she was a girl, see, and she said to me, well, what is this thing about men and women thinking differently? And she had a feeling, somehow, and many women seem to have this feeling, that women are like men, only more so. You know, that if men, quote, hadn't suppressed women for 200,000 years, women would be men, is her feeling. I could see it all the way through the letter. What is this? And yet, I don't think there's a single man who, but what, could not look right here into this voice coil. And all I got to say is, you know what I mean, you know? And he knows when you're talking about the difference between men and women. I think one of the most wild moments of insight that a guy has when he knows this difference is when is when you get involved with a chick who's a beautiful girl, a really lovely girl, and I parenthetically must say that most women today have a feeling that beauty is the most important single element that a girl can have. That beauty is a pursued thing. It's a sought after. In fact, it's a national mania today. It goes even further than that. It's become a national religion. And in some ways it is, you know. It's the only thing that many people believe in. And, of course, since it's the only thing that they believe in, the idea of losing beauty is like losing your religion. It's like losing your life. It's like losing the only thing that counts. It's like a Gothic cathedral slowly sinking into the mud among all the peasants. And so here's this chick frantically holding on to it with every possible thing she can get. And yet you know, viewing it from a man's standpoint, I think that hardly any man who has any taste at all or any kind of perception, but what hasn't had this wild feeling? Do you know the feeling of almost indescribable boredom that sweeps over you when you... I have to go back and say you have to approach this story the right way. It's being attracted by something. A beautiful girl. You see this lovely creature, and you know all the way through the American musical comedy is the myth of beauty and loveliness and grace. Have you ever seen a musical that did not have a beautiful girl as the lead or somehow deeply involved? Almost every movie has a beautiful girl involved. As a matter of fact, I saw an interesting thing happen the other day. A playwright wrote a play, one of the American playwrights, a good one, and one of his characters is described in the play, in his notes, as a very plain girl, as a matter of fact, quite the further than plain, a girl who could be called ugly, who had trouble from the very first day when she looked in the mirror, knowing that she was not a beautiful girl and was far from it, and as a matter of fact was very deeply conscious of that. And because of this consciousness of her lack of beauty, she had become something which none of the others around her were, because they were beautiful. Now, that was the crux of the play. So they were doing the play, they're doing it in Hollywood. So they're looking all over the country for the plain girl. It's interesting to note that the girl they selected as the plain girl was a girl who was a runner-up to Miss America. It's as though we can't let go of this thing no matter what happens. We've got to hang on to this. Somehow people would be a little disturbed if they went into a movie and the girl was not, really wasn't beautiful. So all the way through the play they keep talking about her plainness, but yet we see on the screen that she's beautiful. Where does perception, what is it? Have you ever had the feeling sometimes that there's a great fog somewhere surrounding almost everything that we do? The fog that is almost impenetrable. And so the problem always comes around where you're attracted by this wild beauty, the thing that Richard Rodgers sings of. Across the room, this beautiful thing, this creature floats in. And then you get involved. You meet her. And for the first 6 hours as you talk to her, you begin to believe that she's reticent. She's cool. She plays it cool. And then the next 8 hours after that, you begin to think, maybe something's bugging her. Maybe that's why she isn't talking. And then the next 10 hours of that, afterwards, you begin to realize she's got absolutely nothing to say. And how many men know the almost indescribable boredom of Monday morning, wondering how in the world you ever got involved in this? And the feeling that you want to somehow just to get to some place to have a cup of coffee by yourself. What a great moment of relief. Do you relish being alone? This is one of the most beautiful little pleasures, I think, that our world has left to offer it. And that's the moment of total, well, solitude. Now, total solitude in the city is easy to achieve, really. Because total solitude in the city is different from total solitude in the country. It has nothing to do with being alone. Total solitude can be easily achieved in, let's say, the Horn and Hardart. with 400 other people walking along picking up the beans, going through picking up the pumpkin pie and sitting at the tables. Because there is a way, and we all have it, of just disconnecting ourselves from that which is around us, just sitting there, drinking your coffee, looking off into the middle distance. I'm alone. I'm alone. And that big old cigar in the museum is crumbling. And that chick is going to talk forever about how she had to wear Chinese dresses. And the husband is on his way now to Hong Kong. And somewhere someone is putting up a sign that says, shame. And somebody in Philadelphia is planning to put another rowboat on top of another roof. Did you read that article out of, you know, Philadelphia is one of the nutty cities in the United States. It breaks out like little puffs of smoke. A little puff will pop out of the middle of that beautifully complacent attitude and that wonderfully smooth and creamy exterior of Philadelphia. A couple of nights ago, a woman saw a man climbing up the side of her building, dragging after him a rowboat. And by the time the police arrived, he had left his rowboat and had decamped. And all she could say was, being age 84, I don't want no rowboat on my roof. Take it off. She was afraid someone would come and leave another one there. And that big old cigar keeps crumbling away, 5.5 feet long. The biggest in the world. Yes, outside of Boise, Idaho, 2 years ago, they made the biggest hamburger that was ever made in the United States. And Chicago has the biggest office building that ever was built. And Seattle has the highest restaurant ever built in the United States. And there's a man living in Massillon, Ohio, who has the biggest drinking mug in the state of Ohio. And if you're not careful, you'll have the biggest ego in the world. So pull in your gut. And just to, if you can, all together now, let's go. Hey, we're the biggest. All together now. I just thought you ought to know. But I'm here, you know, I'm with you. You're with me. I wonder if the image of Jack Parr is still hanging out there in the night. Like a faint cloud over Wisconsin. Ah, whither goest thou, O ghost? O bell toller, thou shalt not ring for me. Thou shalt not toll the long, quiet, evil hours of defeat. Not for me thou shalt not. I shall fight from the rooftops. Ah, yes, you're there, aren't you? It's like this time, you know. I guess the first time you begin to realize it, it sneaks up on you. Like this time, I'm this kid, and I had this terrible urge to have this date. There was this girl named Dorothy, you know. In everybody's past, there's a golden girl, or a golden man, or a golden person, someone beyond. Well, beyond touching, really. And there was a golden girl who I knew in school. I must have been about, I think, 14. Yes, in fact, I was a sophomore in high school. And this golden girl was in my biology class. And, you know, biology class, I mean, you dissect a frog together. You work on an earthworm in tandem. You talk about the bees. You talk about the birds and the butterflies together. And there's a certain closeness that begins to develop. Well, Dorothy was my lab partner, and Dorothy and I used to get the knives, and we'd get the frogs out of the formaldehyde, and I was good at that frog business, you know, and I was very, very, very good at earthworms. Well, Dorothy began to appreciate my wielding of the scalpel, and she loved the way that I dumped the formaldehyde into the sinks, and there was just a warm thing that developed between the two of us. But she was from a part of town. I don't know whether you ever lived in a small town, a comparatively small town, where one part of town is the wealthy part of town. That's really the official part of town, where they have big brick houses and lilac trees out in front. And you know, that's something that has to be said about the Midwest. I've been around here in the East now for maybe 10, 12 years. up and down through towns in Connecticut and through New Hampshire and Vermont. But there's one thing that the Midwest does have at this time of the year that is inextricably bound up with school and with spring and with just that part of the world. And that is a tremendous, almost an overgrowth, inundation of lilac bushes. And about this time of the year, you would walk along streets in places like Marion, Indiana, and Muncie, Indiana, and Hammond, Indiana, and you could hardly keep yourself from trying to catch your breath. The lilac smell would be so strong. Tremendous aroma of this, just flowing over the streets. And once in a while, there would be a big snowball bush. Do you have snowball bushes here in the East? Do you know what a snowball bush is? I don't know what they call it. Is that hydrangea, is it? Snowball bush? I know. We just called it a snowball bush, and it would grow up. Well, Dorothy lived in a house that was completely surrounded by lilac bushes, and it had snowball bushes out in front. And it had one of these big yards, you know, that had maybe 100 feet on each side of the house, and great big elm trees, big oak trees. And out in the back, they had a fence all the way around the back, composed entirely of poplars, big, beautiful, tall poplars. She lived in that kind of a place, you know? Big white porch and the whole business. And the father was an official-type father who came and went in a big car and had some big job somewhere in some office in town, in Chicago, as a matter of fact. And she was just completely out of my world. And I remember one day, I'm working on the frog. We were thrown together by the accident of the alphabet. In case you're wondering why she was with me. Her name was Dorothy Smith. And Dorothy, you know, Shepherd Smith, so there we are. You know, the next thing I know, I'm dissecting a nightcrawler with the wildest chick in the biology class. Again, you know, there you are. You see, so we're working away there, and she keeps talking to me about these things that these people had, assuming, of course, that I was part of the same world. And she's saying, Are you going to the sock hop out of Cherry Point tonight? The sock hop at Cherry Point. I mean, well, that's the kind of stuff they said. Don't look at it. That's just the kind of things they did, you know. They had little sororities and fraternities and all that stuff. And all I knew what I was going to do was when I got out of school immediately, I was going to go to George's Paper Emporia, pick up my load of Chicago Herald Americans, and go out on the route. That's what I was going to do. Then after I got off the route, I was going to come home and I was going to go to the store. Then after that, I was going to have an argument with my kid brother. Then after that, I was going to have supper. And then I was going to yell with my old man and everything at the stuff, you know. Then after that, I was going to go out and throw some rocks at the streetlights for a while. Then I was going to go down and see Flick in the basement and have a fist fight maybe and yell around and holler. And then 20 minutes after I was supposed to be home, I was going to come home and go to bed. That's what I was going to do. So she's going to go to the sock hop and she's going to do all this stuff. And I'm of course playing it big. I'm cutting up the worms, and I'm cutting up the frogs. I'm playing it all, you know. Right, like, yeah, of course, sure, yeah. And she kept saying, well, who are you going to take? Who are you going to take? I'd say, oh, well, I don't know yet. Now, who am I going to take? Who am I going to take? For crying out loud. So I'm working away there. Well, finally it happened. I received an enormous bonus of, I think, $5 from George for delivering over 10 million papers. I had just passed the 10 million mark. So, you know, they pinned the wings on. They gave you $5 and all that. I delivered more papers for crying out loud than the Times has made in the last month. So finally I got the wings and I got the buck, the $5. And I ask her, I'll never forget this terrible thing. I ask this girl, Dorothy, if she wants to go out with me. How about a date? She says, fine, good. I said, when? Of course, you know, it was a thing, you know. If I find this, that if you keep your romances on the plane that they start out, you're okay. But if you carry them into another area, you're sunk. Right there, I mean, you're sunk. Forget it. I mean, it's like many a GI found this out. He had this great thing happening to him, you know, over in Germany or in Japan. And then he decided to bring her home. Well, you know what happened. He just said, you know. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote a beautiful story about this called The Ice Palace. Do you remember that story? Magnificent story about the guy and the school and finally bringing her up to Minnesota. And she's looking out of the window and the wind is blowing. And they're having the big winter carnival and she's cold and it just doesn't work. Well, anyway, Dorothy and I, this is what happened. Come Saturday, I arrive at her house. Beautiful place, you know, and I had been past this place 8 million times, but now I'm going inside. So I go inside, I pick up Dorothy. Well, we come out, and I have the car. We get in the car. We go to the place where we're going to eat. We go to the eat, and we eat, and we're sitting there. And, of course, I begin immediately to realize an awful thing happened to me. I'm going to have to confess to you something awful right now. We went to the best restaurant in town, and I had $5, see. They're the best place I could find. Well, in those days, you could get a great meal for about, you know, $1.50 or something like that. And she says to me, she says, there's nothing I like better than scallops. And I says, yeah, I like scallops. My mother makes scallops all the time. I enjoy them. And I'm trying to figure out scallops. Does she mean scallop potatoes? And she says, I love scallops. And I see they have them on the menu. And I look down and it says scallops. And I says, you know, I had never seen scallops on a menu before because we spent our time eating at the Triangle restaurant where they had baked potatoes and fried ham. And I says, scallops? What the hell is scallop? And I thought, scallop potatoes. And I'm trying to hook it up. I says, my mother makes scallops, you know, all the time. We have them on Friday night. You know, she fixes them very great scallops. She says, well, I think I'll have scallops. And so I'm talking away about the scallops. And she says, oh, that's, she asked the waiter, she says, are they fresh? Are they fresh? What's she talking about? Are they fresh? And the guy says, of course they're fresh. Of course our scallops are fresh. And I says, well, I'll have some scallops too, please, as long as they're fresh. And we're waiting there, and the man's bringing the water. He's bringing the knives and the stuff, and he's fooling around like waiters do. And finally, I let it happen. Just terrible boo-boo. I said, of course, my mother always slices them. Do you like them sliced real thin? She says, what? I says, well, scallops, you know. My mother fixes them real thin, and she fixes them with a butter sauce, you know. It's a cream sauce there, and they're great. I like them. She says, I never had scallops with a cream sauce. Sliced thin. What do you mean? I says, well, you know, you slice them thin. I especially like scallops with frankfurters. Well, there was this cold thing that began to settle down, and 5 minutes later, we got the scallops. I have never seen these little round things, and it was downhill all the way, as it's always been, as it always will be.